All right, well, we might make a bit of a start. This session, I'm hoping you're all ready to run. It's a marathon, not a sprint, modelling lifetime care and support for severely injured participants. So Peter Hardy from PwC will be speaking to this paper this afternoon. Peter tells me he's a wannabe marathon runner, but then he subsequently told me that he actually did complete a marathon a couple of weeks ago in Melbourne, which I think he's to be congratulated on. I think marathon running is quite a feat. So Peter's been working for over 20 years in the financial services industry. He specialises in advising injury support schemes on scheme design, valuation, capital management and pricing. I'm sure we're all looking forward to what he has to say. The presentation will go for about 30 minutes. Please do ask questions at the end. There are microphones on either side. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for your time today. With the upcoming implementation of the National Injury Insurance Scheme, the aim of our paper has really been to provide a useful reference document for schemes and actuarial practitioners performing lifetime valuations of care and support costs for severely injured participants. So firstly, something I'm quite passionate about, and that's running, so indulge me for a while. So two of the authors of this paper have run marathons over the last year. Stephanie Duong ran in the Berlin Marathon last year, where a new men's world record was made. And she also ran an ultra marathon out at Ku'ringai in Sydney. As mentioned, last couple of weeks, I ran a marathon in Melbourne as well. And one of the things that struck us was that there were some similarities between running marathons and value lifetime care and support schemes, and that it actually highlights some of the key themes of the presentation today. So firstly, marathons. On the face of it, they seem quite easy. You take one step and then repeat that process about 42,000 times. But underneath all of that, there are some lessons to be learned. First of all, each marathon you need lots of preparation and training, often over 1,000 kilometres over a six-month sort of period to develop the training and the speed to be able to do that. Secondly, you don't really want to build up too quickly or you risk getting injured. I actually broke my ankle during the training period, and Steph had a bad case of shin splints. But the important thing was understanding the cause of those injuries and then reacting appropriately. And lastly, pacing is very important within a race. And really you've got to consider the longer term nature of the race and not just how you're feeling at the time. So for example, in the marathon that I ran, I went out too hard to begin with and didn't leave a lot left in the tank to finish off the race. So then turning our mind to lifetime care and support. Again, on the face of it, it seems very easy. You think about the current payment levels and then you project that out into the future for the future lifetime of the participant. But again, I think there's some lessons to be learned here. The first one is you actually need a lot of preparation. Ideally, what you want to be doing is modelling a scheme participant's journey from the date of injury through acute care, through reintegration back to society, and then taking in the longer term. Secondly, experience can be quite volatile, both in terms of a scheme that's offering lifetime care and support and the participants that are entering into that, but also in terms of the individual participants themselves. So you need to be able to react and respond accordingly and not overreact. And lastly, we are talking about lifelong costings. And so really you need to consider not just the, the current participant characteristics, but the longer term, what that actually means in 100 years' time. If we think about what a lot of people have been talking about, they're talking about schemes being in existence for 30 years. Well, these basically projections will be going out for a lot longer than that. So we're talking, you know, up to 100 years. So firstly, I want to acknowledge and thank the support and collaboration in the model development with New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support, now under iCare. And that scheme, just noting that that scheme actually covers those seriously injured from motor vehicle accidents. And we do show many figures throughout the scheme, throughout the presentation related to that scheme. The other main thing is I'll refer to the people within the schemes as participants. One word of caution as well. I mean, each scheme, as we've seen, I think it's been a recurring theme so far today, is unique in nature, and they'll have their own eligibility conditions, their own participant characteristics, supplier costs, benefit coverages, accounting standards and so forth. So it's you need to think about that before applying it to whatever scheme you're involved with. The methodology that we're discussing today is a result of over 10 years of research from a ground basis up, mainly from John Walsh and his teams over the year, which has been wide and varied. If we turn to the National Injury Insurance Scheme now, so that's due to be rolled out in jurisdictions around Australia over the next few years, and that's going to provide no-fault coverage for lifetime care and support services for those with severe injuries. The intention is that that supplements the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and there's already been some national minimum benchmarks established for some types of injuries, and others are under consideration at the moment. Some schemes will be fully covered already, some will be partly covered for this introduction, and some may not be covered at all. And finally, we focus today on traumatic brain injuries and spinal cord injuries, given that they make up the large proportion of participants entering these schemes. This diagram is a rough roadmap from today. The words aren't important. The depth in the time really reflects time and the fact that we use an annuity approach to actually value the valuation. And the major components working from left to right is really firstly categorising a participant's injury type and severity and the ways to classify this. Secondly, thinking about a participant's status and essentially eligibility for future payments. Thirdly, the mortality basis that's going to be used to project payments into the future. Fourthly, the payments, and specifically the types and the characteristics of those payments that are made to participants. And lastly, the economic assumptions that's adopted. So first, about a little bit about the New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Scheme. The chart on the left there shows the split of the scheme by injury type at the moment, and it shows that about 80% of injuries come from traumatic brain injuries. And that's in the blue. In the orange there shows that about 20% are related to spinal cord injury. And in green, about 2% relate to other injuries. And look, that's mainly multiple amputations, severe burns or blindness. Obviously, other schemes will have different distributions. The middle chart shows the age distribution. And the one thing I'd point out there is that orange category there, which is participants aged 15 to 24. And, you know, it's typically seen as a typical accident hump for motor schemes. The right-hand chart shows the distribution by gender, and there's over 70% of male participants within the scheme. Now, as I mentioned, participants entering the scheme, it can be quite volatile, and sometimes it's very difficult to determine the noise from the trends, and it's important not to overreact to experience in the shorter term. One of the interesting things in the New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Scheme, it's only been up for just over 7 years, is that the number of participants are remaining stable or even decreasing. But there have been a higher number of older participants entering the scheme. If we think about injury severity for spinal cord injuries, there's two main factors that we look at. The first is the neurological level of injury, and that's really where in the spinal cord that the break occurs. And so the parts of the body from the break point down, obviously the movement can be impaired, and the higher the level of break in the spinal cord, the less potential movement you might have there. The second aspect we look at, though equally important, is the completeness of the injury. And so that's how, I suppose, the damage that's actually been done to the spinal cord. And that really dictates the level of motor and sensory function. That's commonly measured on what's called an ASIA scale, where a rating from A to E is given, where A basically means complete lack of motor or sensory function, whereas E means full function has returned. In our work, we categorise ASIA scores A to C because they have very similar payment patterns, and we call those complete injuries. And we call those with ASIA scores D and E incomplete injuries, and they have a much lower cost. For lifetime care and support participants, as shown in the chart on the right, about 2 in 3 basically suffer from complete injuries, and about 44% would relate to the cervical aspect of the spine and could potentially be in quadriplegics. If we think about traumatic brain injury, I think it's fair to say it's more difficult to have an objective assessment at the date of injury, and there's lots of different measures around. Post-traumatic amnesia relates to the period of memory loss post the injury. The functional independence measure, often called FIM, assesses physical and cognitive disability over 18 different dimensions. And you can get scores between 18, which is the most severe, and 126, which is the least severe. And finally, what's used within the New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Scheme is what's called the Care and Need Scale, often referred to as the CAN scale, and that was developed by Robin Tate. Effectively, there's 8 separate levels that's used, from 0 to 7, where 0 talks about independent living, while 7 means they've got continuous attendant care support being required. But noting that that can actually still range quite broadly in terms of care and support requirements. So in New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support, they make initial assessments as close as practical to the injury and then do ongoing and regular assessments for the first 5 years since injury and then less regular but still ongoing assessments from 5 years. The chart on the right shows the distribution within the scheme, showing that nearly 1 in 5 brain injury participants cover CAN 7, which is continuous attendant care support required. CANS 4 is also a very broad category, covering a reasonably broad range of care hours. And I do note that the distribution does vary by age, generally with older participants having higher CANS scores. One of the important aspects of traumatic brain injuries is that participants can and do show material improvement after the initial shock and impact of the accident, especially in the first 2 years since that accident, although you can get, I suppose, improvements but also deteriorations. And we allow for this in our evaluation using a transition approach, which measures how participants move from one CANS category to another over time. The key themes coming from that analysis really is that younger participants have the potential to show greater improvements than older participants. And secondly, that level of improvement diminishes quite significantly over time. And that really highlights that early intervention may have a large impact on influencing longer-term outcomes for traumatic brain injury. So participant status is something that I suppose typical injury schemes might talk about a claim being either open or closed. But for the New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Scheme, because it's a standalone scheme, it's a very important concept in terms of being eligible for payments. Now, if you think about the scheme itself, on the one hand, you want to limit the number of participants entering into the scheme to control costs, and you really want to limit it to those severely injured. But on the other hand, you actually want to enable early intervention to injuries that might otherwise develop into serious injuries, and so where early intervention might actually help the longer-term outcomes. So there's essentially rules that determine what's called an interim eligibility to the scheme for the first 2 years. Then after those 2 years, participants are then assessed for lifetime eligibility, and that's basically assessment for payment for basically for life. If they don't satisfy that criteria, that 2-year point, then they're deemed what's called not lifetime participants. And you know, for example, that may be brain injury participants who may present and improve greatly over 2 years and regain either close to or full independence. Furthermore, there are some participants within the scheme that may cease to continue on benefits for various reasons, and we call those lapsed participants, and they can and have represented themselves to the scheme later on down the track. So each of these different participant statuses, as we call them, have different care and support requirements over their lifetime, and we consider their valuation separately. So one of the key aspects is the mortality basis that's used for the valuations. And there's a reasonable amount of literature around the topics, but each of those has limitations. I think it's worthwhile noting at the outset, even those who are most severely injured participants can have life expectancy of between 50 and 60% of normal life expectancies, while the less severely injured participants, but still severely injured participants in the scheme, can have life expectancy of 95% or more of normal life expectancies. And hence, there's a very long projection period, often up to 100 years in terms of you thinking about future cash flows. In terms of modelling mortality, there's 3 main different approaches which all hinge on using normal mortality. The first one is an addition to the normal mortality rate. The second is a multiplier to the normal mortality rate. And third is rating up ages to additional levels to allow for the injury severity. And what we found is that no single approach actually works best across all the ages. And this makes sense if you consider the additional sources of mortality for those severely injured participants. So if we think about spinal cord injury participants, they're particularly suspect to septicemia, pneumonia and respiratory type additional forces of mortality, whereas for brain injury participants, epilepsy, aspiration, pneumonia and external forces such as suicide dominate. And so they can actually have very different implications at different ages and also in relation to the normal mortality population. The current approach that we use is to use a multiplier approach, but one that actually decreases over age. So it takes into account that, especially at the younger ages, it's these other sources of mortality which actually do dominate. But at the older ages, just general ageing has much of a greater impact relative to those other. So we calibrate our assumptions based on life expectancies, which you can get from the literature that's around. And so that's one way you can calibrate these. One of the things that we found within the lifetime care and support scheme is that there's the first year mortality effect, which is quite well documented, that is that the mortality rate in the first year since injury is quite a lot higher than for future years. We don't see that within the scheme. And a lot of that is because those participants that may have died within a year of injury maybe don't present to the scheme. So again, it shows the importance of just thinking about the different types of scheme that you've got, the eligibility and also the entry requirements. One of the subjective parts of the valuation basis, in my view, is the mortality improvements and whether you allow for that and how you allow for that. And there's no real clear evidence around this over the longer term. Certainly in the shorter term, first year or second year, there's been significant improvements over the last 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 years around that, with long-term survival rates reducing quite significantly. But in the longer term, there's less evidence. If you think about so the Australian government actually produces life mortality improvement factors every 10 years or so, and so you can use that as a guide to see what sort of general improvements in population mortality there are, and the table on the right there shows what sort of increases in liability you might get from adopting those normal mortality improvements. And what it does show to me is that those allowing for those future mortality improvements can be quite significant in terms of the costing of the scheme. The mortality experience is accumulating within New South Lifetime Care and Support, and in a couple of years' time, I think, much better position, basically, to do some more detailed analysis around that. So if we move on to payments. Now, one of the key underpinnings, I suppose, of the governance of a lot of these schemes in Australia is this definition of providing care and support that's reasonable and necessary. And interpretations can and do vary between different schemes, but they typically revolve around certain criteria. And that criteria may mean value for money in terms of the services being provided. What are the community expectations around what's reasonable and necessary? Are the care and supports helping the participant to achieve their lifetime goals? So, for example, if there's a new piece of expensive technology that's around, to what extent does the scheme actually use that, utilise that in their scheme? So the chart on the table there shows a typical participant's costs by various payment categories, noting that the patterns will vary by injury severity, age and so forth. So this is for an average participant. And noting that the cash flows also include the impact of mortality. So the dark blue line there represents attendant care, and that's the lion's share of, I suppose, future payments in the longer term. The red line there talks about hospital costs, and you can see high upfront costs there as the participants receive acute care and rehabilitation that tapers off over time. Both rehabilitation and medical is the lighter blue line and the green line there, which also have high upfront costs, but again taper over time, but still remain significant. And then we also look at equipment and home modifications and case management separately because they're quite important in terms of, I suppose, the scheme governance. So if we think about a new scheme that's started under the National Injury Insurance Scheme and what the cash flows of that scheme might look like, it might look like something on the chart here. And really the key points in the first 3 years, you're probably going to expect hospital costs to dominate. Over time, though, attendant care is going to quickly replace that as a major payment type as it increases linearly over time. Rehabilitation is another cost, which also increases linearly over time. And the other payment types, they're probably a lower magnitude, but they still will gradually drift up over time. So attendant care costs. This is the largest payment type. And we model this as basically the number of hours of care, which varies by injury type and injury severity. We multiply that by an hourly rate. Then we multiply that by utilisation, where that varies by the duration since injury. at low and then increases. And then we multiply that further by an age adjustment factor, which increases with age. And so the purpose of the utilisation and the age adjustment factors is really to identify periods in a participant's life when more or less attendant care is going to be required. For example, if a younger participant leaves home for the first time, what does that mean in terms of attendant care and support? What happens if they have a breakdown or they have a new relationship, and what does that mean? Similarly, if they have a new job or they lose their job, what does that mean? And also general ageing, illnesses, and the availability of respite care, they can all have influences. But we take a longer-term approach when we're actually calibrating, I suppose, these assumptions, noting that participants' circumstances will change over time. So the chart on the left there shows typical usage post-injury for an average participant. You notice the gradual build-up representing greater reliance post-injury as the participant is released from hospital. It also reflects the fact that a participant is likely to have higher family and community support early on since their injury, but over time that may actually reduce slightly. The actual level of care then stabilises about year 7 to 8 and then sort of gradually reduces over time, but that's really just the impact of mortality. The right-hand chart shows what a typical new National Injury Insurance Scheme payments might look like, with the dark line being the cash flows from the new scheme and the dotted line being the proportion of payments in the scheme that relate to attendant care, which you can see increases up to about 70% in the longer term. The two charts here looks at, I suppose, the how costs vary by injury type and injury severity. So spinal cord on the left-hand side there and traumatic brain injury on the right. And as expected, the more severe injuries obviously require a much greater level of care. And the care costs are pretty much dominated by, I suppose, the complete spinal cord injuries and also the higher CANS levels. The other thing to note about this is probably the higher in general sort of care level requirements for spinal cord injuries relative to the brain injuries. So participants will spend a lot of time, a significant amount of time in hospital directly after injury, and that contributes to a significant proportion of the scheme costs. However, one thing to consider here is important to understand, I suppose, the sporadic hospital billing practices that might be around, the bulk billing practices, and also the interactions with the public health system there, which can vary by jurisdiction. So modelling for medical costs are similar to what's shown on there for hospital costs, but the upfront costs are quite a bit lower, whereas the ongoing costs are reasonably similar. So aids and equipment can represent a number of different things. It may be equipment such as wheelchairs for spinal cord injury participants. It might be prostheses for those with multiple amputations. It might be vehicle modifications, or it might be disposables and their equipment. And it also covers not just the initial provision of these, but also the ongoing replacement and maintenance. So the shape of the payments since injuries is high following the accident, but then remain at a reasonably significant level, and that aligns with the replacement and maintenance of that existing equipment. And what you might find is about 6% of scheme costs might relate to aids and equipment, and that's pretty stable over the lifetime of the scheme. Most spinal cord injury participants would need some form of equipment, while less severely brain injury participants might not require any aids or equipment at all. So not shown up here is home modification costs, but they would follow a very similar sort of pattern to this, but obviously a much higher outlay and probably a lower frequency. So rehabilitation costs cover a wide variety of services. That might be things such as pain management, behaviour management, counselling, transition to work, speech pathology, social work, physiotherapy, and so forth. We also include participant and provider travel in these costs, noting that it's actually quite significant, but you could equally look at those separately. So you can see there about 12 to 17% of initial costs might be around rehabilitation and 7% in the longer term, so it's quite a significant part of a participant's journey. There is less differentiation in costs early on since injury, with greater differentiation over time. Most participants would utilise some form of rehabilitation as part of their case management plan. So there are some similarities between case management and rehabilitation. And really, the assessment of case management plans and the individual needs of participants are an extremely important part of the governance and risk management service provided by some of these schemes. Lifetime Care and Support, they purchase case management services as they can be very complex to deliver. And the provision of those services, keeping in mind, can impact the longer-term health outcomes, especially in terms of early injury management. And in some cases, particularly for low-level brain injuries, the provision of case management services can actually replace the need for attendant care services. So that provides a very valuable role as well. Okay, so economic assumptions. I've talked already about the lifetime nature of these benefits, but what that means is the levies, the contributions, the payments that are made for various participants in a funded scheme need to be invested over that period of time to provide inflation protection over that period. Now, the mean term of some of these schemes can be over 25 years, which is a massive amount of time. And what that means is valuation results are very sensitive to the economic assumptions that are used. So a 1% difference between the future inflation assumption and the earning rate or the discount rate that's used on the funds can change the liability by upwards of 20%. I note that current accounting standards, they're pretty much all geared and also professional standards around the use of risk-free discount rates. And so there's a question about, well, what does that actually mean for schemes of this duration? The table on the right there shows just the monthly change in liability estimates if you blindly applied sort of risk-free rates under sort of two sort of common methodologies that I've seen for longer tail schemes. And they're quite massive changes in liability estimates you could get just month on month. So those movements in economic assumptions, in my view, are just a distraction to the scheme, and they can dwarf some of the other emerging trends within the scheme. And what that means is you could actually risk making the wrong decisions about the scheme if you do adopt that sort of approach. And so what that means is we consider basically longer-term expectations on economic assumptions, and I'd sort of view that as taking the marathon view rather than the sprint approach. We actually advocate use of a fixed gap approach where that's actually allowable under accounting and professional standards. So if we put all this together, what we've got here is some benchmark results around average traumatic brain injury claim sizes. And you can see there that lifetime care and support costs for long-term can severity going down and age severity across to the right, with the green ones being the lower average costs and the red being the higher costs. So what it shows is that the most severely injured and the younger participants, they can expect care and support costs in excess of about $10 million on our valuation basis, with more moderately injured participants still expected to receive over $1 million. But there's quite a broad range there in costs. And an average participant for a brain injury may cost under $2 million. So CAN-7 participants, which is the most severely injured, account for about 62% of the total traumatic brain injury costs, while CANs-3 and below account for probably 10% of the scheme cost. And what that demonstrates to me, again, is this whole idea of the early intervention, the fact that if you can get, early outcomes within the brain injury participants, that can lead to favourable longer-term outcomes. So for spinal cord injuries, we've got down the side, neurological level and completeness of injury. And while the costs still vary quite significantly, there is, I think, less variation than shown with traumatic brain injuries. And, you know, that's reflecting less opportunity for injury severity improvements and also, on average, the higher, attendant care costs and other support costs. And the average there is just over $3 million per participant. So the most severely injured and younger age groups may expect future care and support costs in excess of $15 million. And incomplete spinal injuries may have costs which are within the range of 3 to 6 times lower than, those with complete injuries. So based on that, about 57% of spinal cord injury costs really relates to complete quadriplegic claims, while the incomplete injuries reflect about 16% of total spinal cord injury cost. So this is really an entire topic in itself in terms of talking about outcomes. And really it's recognising that there are many other factors influencing cost and that many of those factors are very important as well. things such as personal resilience of participants, social participation, other injuries that the participant may have, and the strength of key relationships and also the strength of the family structures, and also other non-financial outcomes. And so these non-financial outcomes are very important, and in the longer run, I believe that they will influence cost outcomes. A scheme doing this well will get better participant outcomes and probably also operate at a much lower longer-term cost. So measurement of these non-financial outcomes, I think, becomes very important for schemes such as New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support and any scheme that's providing this sort of coverage. And for that to be embedded into scheme cultures, I think, will be very important. And so it leads to the importance of monitoring not just financial outcomes but non-financial outcomes and having a strong monitoring framework around that. And so to do that, you obviously need the data to support it. And I think going forward, if I think about 10 years' time, it'll be useful to actually benchmark the different schemes and see what different things are making a difference between the different schemes that are providing care and support like this. Certainly, we're aware that the National Disability Insurance Scheme is developing an outcomes-based framework and that that would be really useful to implement into schemes such as the New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Scheme. So before I close, I think in many ways I feel like I've sprinted through this material and that the marathon version of this actually would go into much greater detail around things such as the genesis of the models, the emerging scheme trends, a more full discussion on mortality and economic assumptions, and also the importance of focusing on those participant outcomes. With the National Injury Insurance Scheme rolling out soon, we hope that this provides a valuable starting line for further discussions and research. And indeed, our own models are constantly evolving as we gather more reliable experience around the scheme. Don't forget, there's also another paper that goes along with this that explores some of these issues in much more detail. And I just hope that it's not too much of a marathon for people to get through. So thank you for your time today. So any questions?
Hi, John Wren, ACC Research. Thanks for that. Really, I'm just thinking about future implications, use of this work, in particular in the context of, in reflecting upon the work, do you have any thought what some of this work means for value of preventable fatality, value of statistical risk calculations? And secondly, is there any intention within Australia in implications for costing out injury prevention estimates in the ACC scheme in terms of injury prevention? We're going through a cycle within the scheme of currently we have to do estimates on what's the return to the levy payer from an injury prevention. People like myself have historically done cost of injury estimates valued based on value of preventable fatality, of which, as you've indicated, you've pretty much outlined direct costs. Then there's a whole bunch of social and economic costs. In New Zealand, we're running at around about $200,000 for direct costs per year. And then if you're putting in a social factor, we're running at around about $4.8 million.
So I didn't quite get the first question, but certainly in terms of the second question, I think even in the first 10 years of New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Scheme, we are seeing trends around injury prevention and so forth. As I mentioned earlier, I think the number of participants entering the scheme has either been stable or, if not, slowly decreasing. It's hard to make that call, I think, because the ups and downs by year is quite significant. But we have seen the profile of those claims changing as well. And I think it's probably fair to say early days yet, but the accident hump where we talk about the 15 to 24 to 35 sort of age group, we are seeing some improvements in that. But again, whether that's just a blip in terms of volatility or whether it's a longer term trend, I think it's those types of things which are quite interesting to see. So you're seeing the impact of, I suppose, the road and traffic safety improvements and so forth coming through there.
Peter, I was interested that you talked about some of the additional factors at the end, or sort of highlighted them. To what extent, when you're actually looking at these claims, are you attempting to bring that into the valuation rather than, obviously, what you've brought up is a great list of sort of the benchmarks and things. Obviously, with 10 years of experience, you can look at the individual nuances of some claims. So to what extent are you able to overlay some of those comorbidities and things that as they roll through?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the purpose of your valuation. And certainly if you're looking at, looking at putting together lifetime care and support packages for individual participants, they become very important. And again, the case managers are able to overlay. So what they'll do is they'll use our models, but they'll be able to actually overlay some of the factors for these things. So they're actually being used at a participant by participant level to say, well, this is what a typical participant might do, but let's overlay what the personal circumstances of that participant is. If you're doing a valuation, a scheme valuation, I don't think it's necessarily all that important, but it's also useful to think about that in the context of what's happening within the scheme, because obviously to the extent that you're able to change that, that makes sense. Again, getting back to, I suppose, one of the main points is you're looking at a lifetime valuation here, and that individual circumstances can and do change. And if you think about yourself 10 years ago, and not even having a severe injury or anything like that, how have you changed over that time? So to me, I think, yes, there is a role that's been played, and something I haven't discussed throughout the paper today is around what the purpose of your valuation is, and I think you really need to think about that. If it's a budgeting purpose, if it's to put a number in the balance sheet, if it's to think about what the cash flows might look like over the next 10 years and so forth, you need to take that into account.
I'll ask you to thank Peter in the usual way.